couple people still coming. Here we go. Dear Ashton, recently technology, example artificial intelligence, cognitive enhancements, biological improvements to one's DNA, has been growing at an exponential rate, unprecedented in humankind. For example, artificial intelligence has shown ideation and creativity beyond humans. What job is left for humans? How would Darwin evolve to meet the new challenges? Artificial intelligence is not something which imitates human beings. Once I see artificial stupidity, then I know that that's the same as human beings. In other words, it would be very fascinating for actually to see a machine who does exhibit emotions, who gets fed up, or bored, or makes mistakes. So, artificial intelligence, I think, has still got a long way to go. And again, all artificial intelligence is programmed somewhere, and even if you program it yourself, program, I don't know where it will end up. But fortunately, intelligence is not the most important thing. It's to have insights, have innovation. It takes much more than what we call intelligence. For example, I grew up with some very intelligent people, Nobel Prize winners, who were as intelligent as they come. But as soon as I went to see an Ajahn Chah, then that was wisdom. And I always make a difference between wisdom and intelligence. Intelligence is what you learn. Wisdom sees much deeper and further than that. So if I can see a computer which gets into jhana and comes up, blissed out of its circuit boards, then maybe I can think, wow, you're getting somewhere. But anyway, let's wait and see what happens. It was mentioned in the sutra class earlier regarding the ceasing of the citta. Does it mean that what we carry from the past life to the present one is only the karmic energy? Please comment, thank you. You could call it karmic energy. And if you use the word energy, there is something, a core principle of physics, which I'm sure that you remember, that energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can be changed from mass to energy, energy back to mass. That is a nuclear reaction source of that power. But it cannot be created or destroyed. So, where did this universe come from? How can we suddenly have this energy where energy cannot be created or destroyed? Was the beginning of time, if you look at it that way, an anomaly of the laws of physics? And of course the answer is no. In science there is such a thing as negative energy, just as same as in human emotions. But what I mean negative energy, one example of that which I'm sure that some of you know, it's very simple, it's called potential energy in science class in school. If you've got a heavy object like me to take me out of the Earth's gravitational field, it will take much more energy to take me out of the gravitational field than someone who's thin and skinny. It is a negative component to energy because you have to lose energy to escape from some things like electromagnetic or gravitational fields. It's a negative energy. And so, I was just thinking on my feet, as they say, in a debate with the top scientists in Western Australia. And I said, look, if energy, mass can't be created and destroyed, and we have all this stuff here right now, this energy, what would it be like if the amount of negative energy in the universe totally literally equals the positive energy. So you can imagine every black hole, every star system, every little star in this vast universe could all come together. Would it be a bang, or would it just all cancel each other out? A zero sum. And that was, I remember, this Professor David Blair, who was my co-presenter, looked at me, really quite surprised, that you are so up to date. Omega equals one. I didn't know what omega meant. He explained it to me afterwards. But it was the ratio of this positive energy to negative energy in the universe. And so he confirmed to me that every bit of stuff in this universe all came into one point. It wouldn't be a big bang. It would just cast itself out. It's a zero-sum universe. That means we can come from nothing. We can go back to nothing. Because all the time, there's nothing really here. We started from zero. We are a zero-sum. So we can come back and totally cancel each other out. You haven't got a soulmate. You've got your antiparticle. Somewhere. You meet together. I only made it that bit up. But the rest is very true. So yes, exactly. You can cease. And so can the universe cease. It's a beautiful concept. Some people think it's very disastrous. What? You mean we're all going to be exterminated? I said yes. Sooner or later. You came from nothing. You go back to nothing. Because nothing is perfect. Imagine, I would like to share my understanding on the weakness method. Yes, it is definitely not suitable for the physical, mental, weak meditator due to its military routine. But many Buddhist friends have praised this method as they can see the anicca in pain. When they were out of the center, they can move on to other methods. It can be helpful for some people, but it has its dangers. As long as people know those dangers, and they make sort of appropriate safeguards. You should be really aware of what's happening. And when it comes to Buddhist meditation, actually the stuff which gets you enlightened, then straight away that there's a few people, they do get these things called nimittas, which I mentioned this afternoon, and I'll spend more time talking about tomorrow morning. And unfortunately, those teachers don't know anything about it. Just follow what Karika says. Be careful of that. Don't get into it. It's dangerous. It's not. That's the path to enlightenment. So it does block a lot of people from getting full enlightenment. And unfortunately, because it's a closed system in the Karika tradition, you're not supposed to go and read anything except their literature. Go to their retreats. That's a sign it's dangerous. If you could go on any retreat, say you went to Goenka before, you went to a Zen retreat before, you're welcome, fine. But anyone who says no, the only people who can come to executive retreats are people who follow Ajahn Brahm's method and nothing else. And don't do anything else. There's something very wrong there. So be careful. It has good points. I get these two fabrics on a wall. It's good to know those fabrics in the wall so they don't fall on you. I've been meditating for years lately, feeling vacuum emptiness and diminishing fear of death. Also being asking, who am I frequently? Is this phenomenon normal? Yes, it is normal. But don't ask, who are you? Because that's an endless pursuit. You ask, what do I assume I am? What do I take myself to be? Who do you think you are? That's more important. And if any of those assumptions are challenged, that is shown by the arising of fear. If you're about to die, then if fear comes up, that shows that there is some assumption that this body belongs to you, is important to you, is who you think you are. Intellectually, you know you're going to die. But experientially, is that that deep? That when the doctor says you're going to die, you've only got a few months to live, as again one of those great monks from Khetri Dharmananda, when his doctor told him he only had a couple of months to live and he's going to die, there's no cure there, he burst out laughing. And the doctor, who I met a couple of times in Kuala Lumpur, he said that's the only person, including monks and nuns, the only person he's ever met, that when he told him you're going to die in 2 months, there's no cure, where she laughed. Could you do that? If you go home, you've got some sort of lump in your breast or something, or you feel a bit bad, and the doctor says to you, it's terminal, nothing you can do. Would you laugh? Why not? You're going to die anyway. So, get it over and done with. That's the first thing on my bucket list. To die. Once I get that done, well, what's the alternative? People say, I'm always getting troubled by this, there's a good argument. If you eat healthy food and exercise, you can add a couple of years onto your life. But those couple of years are added on at what time in your life? At the end, when you can't really enjoy it. They're added on in the old people's home. It'd be nice if you can add the 2 years on now. That'd be a different, I'd enjoy it now, with my age now. Instead of just extending your old age. Old age is suffering, sickness is suffering. So who wants to extend it? Because we think it belongs to us. Instead of asking who am I, what do you take yourself to be? What makes you afraid? What are you afraid of losing? There are some people afraid of dementia. Why? I'm losing my mind. Doesn't matter if it wasn't yours to begin with. Using your intelligence, or so what? Intelligence always disappears. You start your life with no teeth. It wasn't the dentist, you end your life with no teeth. The guys, you start with no hair, you end with no hair. And all of us, we start this world wearing nappies, and you end this world life wearing nappies as well. You just go back to where you started from. Anyway, how could that stay? There's quite normal to feel vacuum emptiness, but as I said today, make sure you also get some happiness and joy as well. Otherwise, it just, without that happiness and joy coming, sometimes the meditation doesn't really buy. It doesn't really make it to the next levels. So try to develop the happiness and joy in the meditation when it comes up. Oh, yeah, get into it. You're not supposed to be afraid of that happiness and joy. So, it should be happening naturally, but the less you do, the less you're still thinking and talking and watching the TV and going for walks and stimulating yourself, if you can just relax more and do more mindfulness, more stillness, it's natural that the energy starts to build up, the mindfulness increases, you start to get happy. That's the nature of this. So if you're not happy, it means you'll be doing too much. Your mind hasn't energized. Could you clarify equanimity versus I don't care? I don't care is not equanimity. I don't care is negativity. It's aversion. What equanimity is being able to look on something without reacting. When is there time to have equanimity? Remember, equanimity is only one of the four bubbly houses, three others. And the best simile of equanimity is that old story of one of my fellow school teachers when I was teaching, who was in the British Army in Burma during the Second World War, out in the jungles on patrol with about six other soldiers. The scout came back to tell the bad news. They were surrounded by Japanese enemy troops. Totally outnumbered. No way out. At war, prepare yourself to die. He thought that was it, that was the end of it. This was war. Totally outnumbered. no place to escape, surrounded. And this was a guy who thought, I'm going to be like Bruce Willis. I'm going to be like Arnie Schwarzenegger. I am going to be the tough guy. We're going to fight our way out. Who knows? We may all die, but this is the patriotic thing to do. It was the stupidity, the teachings of John Wayne. So ridiculous. It didn't work in your life. One of the monks, he was actually in the US Marines during the Vietnam War, and he was talking over a cup of tea. He said, remember one of those John Wayne movies? And he picked up the machine gun, and he just, because one of his best friends had been killed, and he got over the trench and he just machine gunned all of the enemy and became the hero. And he said, look, a real machine gun, you know, even a wedding gun is worth it, it couldn't lift one. They're really heavy. Totally ridiculous goal, yeah? You know, it's what people like to see. So, anyway, no one would have escaped. They'd all been killed. And the captain said, no, I do not give you permission to go and find your way out. Instead, said the captain, his famous order, he said, I order everyone to sit down and have a cup of tea. Now remember, this was in the jungles, in Burma, during the Second World War. Serious life and death stuff. And who cares about having a cup of tea when you're about to die? An Englishman would. Especially the British Army, we like our tea. And I tell everybody, that's one of the reasons why, as soon as I heard there was this great meditation master called Ajahn Chah, anyone whose second name meant tea was a monk for me. But anyway, yeah, so they had no choice. And this guy, who is now the English head of English at the school I taught for 1 year, he has said the most stupid thing he's ever done in his life, he thought. Absolutely madness. Thinking of having a cup of tea when you're about to die in a country thousands of miles from home, for war, but you have to follow orders, no choice. And as they were drinking their tea before they were finished, the scout came back and said, put all the stuff away quickly and quietly. The enemy's moon, I can find a way out. And they all crawled through that gap in the surrounding forces and they all escaped. And why he could tell me the story. He said that's the wisdom of his captain saved his life. So often in his life, he had cancer too, he said nothing you could do, but just relax. And it went away. So often in life, we know how to do things. We know how to struggle and strive. But when there's a time when all struggle, all strive, this makes matters worse. We've never learned the skill just to sit down, relax, and have a cup of tea. Have a coffee if you want. Orange juice. Relax. And wait until the time is something to do. So, when there's nothing to do, nothing effective you can achieve, sit down and have a cup of tea. Do nothing. That's called equanimity. And then when there is something to do, give anything you've got. That's really important. That was Ajahn Chah's teaching. Whatever you do when it's time to meditate, give everything you've got. When you go home to do your business, give everything you've got. When you go past the donation box on the way out, give everything you've got. It never works. Anyway, that's what equanimity is. It's not that not caring. It's a heart of caring. I have gotten used to imagining your voice as an internal guide for the beginning of my meditation. Ah, the brainwashing has worked. However, it is sort of developed into an endless chatter of your teachings on what to do and what not to do, deep in meditation. What to do now? Listen to my
Remember that.
Ajava Sharma. See if you remember.
Silence. It's no good remembering the words.
Remember the silence. And then you can remember those teachings, but you also remember when the words have been done, now do the job. Last night I asked about the fear of flying, but I was not quite clear about the regression part of the answer. Can you elaborate on that? Thank you very much. There are many people as part of modern therapy who put you under hypnosis, and they take you into a very skillful, take you into a previous life. And there, quite often, if it's a fear of flying, you recall an occasion when you died in a plane crash. Maybe more likely, it's not that many plane crashes, even though they always get on the news, more likely during things like the Second World War, when there's many people die. One of my uncles, never met him, he died as a fighter pilot in the Second World War. His name was Eric. We always used to talk about him. And tragedy, just being an Air Force pilot in the British Air Force Second World War. But many people died. And so that is probably, you can understand, you know, you had a terrible experience once, the post-traumatic stress just goes into your future life. And it seems to be, the evidence is quite clear, that when you remember that, whether it's a real memory or it's not a real memory, it doesn't really matter, when you recall it, then the traumatic part of it tends to diminish quite significantly, if not go away altogether, the fear of flying goes. You relive it, and then it's not fearful anymore. So that's, but not everyone can be hypnotized. So that's one of the reasons why I give it a try. If it's a skillful hypnotist, they will know pretty easily first time when it's possible it's worthwhile continuing or not, sometimes even the first time. If you can trust it and don't be afraid and let go, then you find you can be taken back into a previous life and remember why it is. Why are you afraid of flying? It's almost certainly that you died in a plane crash somewhere sometime. And it's that part of the mind that gets afraid. Can an imager appear in a few seconds only, or it has to be real deep meditation that occurs? We'll talk about imagers tomorrow, but anyway, if you just had very deep meditation 5 or 10 minutes ago, the mind is still powerful and peaceful, then of course you can shut your eyes and it's right there again. But that's only if you've had a very deep meditation recently. For most people, what you see at the beginning of the meditation isn't the real limiter, it's just the mind playing around. So I wouldn't even bother with those ones. It's much better to follow the usual course and be able to, and not to choose to watch the breathing, but the breathing happens and it gets very peaceful and very delightful and you get lots of happiness with just being peaceful with the breath. So all the thinking is mostly stopped. Any sounds a long way away, and then when imagers come up, they're very real good ones and very stable. Anything that happens in the beginning is usually unstable. What are your views on having different teachers from different traditions, etc.? Mahayana, Zen, etc. All of them bring peace and make me a more peaceful person. How do I know which is the right path? I know you said last night that you should. If it's the right path if the teachers bring peace. Something on wisdom. But what if all of them are wise in their own right? Great! When I went to university, I never had one teacher in science. I had many teachers. And I got the best from each one. So it's the same. If you are a Buddhist, you take refuge. The three refuges. And the three refuges are in the Buddha and the Dhamma, and it's the third refuge, it's not in Ajahn Brahm. The third refuge is not in Thich Nhat Hanh or His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The third refuge is in the Sangha, the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Not one monk or nun or teacher, but many. So that's why we don't have guru tradition in Buddhism. So we just, wherever you can find good teachings, go for that. Try it out. If they are really good teachings, you'll find it's just looking at the same thing from a different angle. And then you can actually really enjoy a good teaching somewhere, brings peace and wisdom. Oh, go for it. In meditation, should we try to force the mind to be in the present moment? No. While in sitting walking meditation, unknowingly my mind starts to reflect on past and future planning. Then suddenly I get wake up from these thoughts and get to know I was in the past and future. This time I can refocus my attention to the breath. If my mind awareness is strong, I can detect when past memories arise quickly. Otherwise, I something forget about meditation, wandering past present for a long time. I'm doing meditation sometime, but I don't see any improvement beyond the past cycle. Am I correctly doing meditation? And are we still be able to make peace with wandering mind in the past and future? Yeah, that's one of the best ways. Because there was a standard piece of advice which I followed for years because I just believed what people told me. If the mind wanders off, bring it back. And then it wandered off again, and I brought it back again. And it wandered off, and I brought it back. It wandered off, I brought it back. It wandered off, I brought it back. I wandered off, I brought it back. And it always wandered off again. And I thought, hang on, I'm wasting too much time. So instead of using force, using willpower, you use wisdom power. Why does it wander off? Why, when I'm just watching my breathing, say, it's nice watching my breath. And all those thoughts, past and future, oh, they just really are a pain in the brain. Why can't I just let them go? So instead of using willpower, I use wisdom power, insight. Why? Because the mind keep wandering away. And then I looked at similar things in my life. Why did a girlfriend leave me? Why did I lose a friend? It was because I wasn't kind to them. That's why. They didn't like being around me when I tried to control them. But I asked too much from them. And so, if you have a boss who's always controlling you, telling you what to do, do you like staying extra hours with that boss? Or is it you try and escape from as soon as you possibly can? Of course you avoid people who cause you suffering. The people who you like, who are kind and wise, you like to hang out with them. So that's the answer. It's because I treated my mind like a control freak first. Right, no more thinking of the past. You behave, mind, otherwise you'll be in trouble, Trying to use fear, cajoling it, and it never worked. And I was kind to my mind. Never mind, mind. If you want to wander off and think all these stupid thoughts, you can. Because I'll be here when you come back. Been so kind to my mind never wanted to wander off. Because we had a beautiful attitude together, my mind and I became best friends. Never fought, fighting, or putting each other down, never telling us what to do. Sometimes in non-meditation retreats, I ask people to use the skillful means, but you ask your mind, what do you want to do now? Whatever your mind answers, follow it. So the mind says, I want to have a really juicy, hot sexual fantasy. Oh, but that's what you want to do, mind, off you go. Oh, you tell the mind wants, I want to fall asleep, I've had enough. Okay, mind, you fall asleep if you want. Oh, I want to write my autobiography. Okay, mind, that's what you want to do. And you'll be surprised. If you are kind to your mind like that, the mind doesn't want to escape, it doesn't want to do any of those things. He just wants to chill out with you, be peaceful with you. So this, when your heart is the mind never wants to wander off. And all those thoughts and fantasies just escape, that's all. What are you escaping from? You're only escaping from the self. So that's the reason why the mind wanders. Not enough kindness, enough gentleness. Those of you who've got cats, your cat will run away if you're unkind to it. If you're so kind to that cat, then okay, the cat might wander away for a while. It'll come back again. But it likes you. It likes your face. You're really gentle and kind to it. That's why it keeps hanging out to you. So nature teaches us. We wander off because there's some problem with the relationship. It's because there's not enough kindness. You expect too much from your meditation. Know your expectations. And then you make faster progress. Oops. Dear Arjuna, from what we learned today, Anapanasati alone can lead to enlightenment. This is correct. Totally correct. That's just a question. That's what the Buddha said. That's what happens. So, when people say, oh, should we do something else now? You don't need to. This is a natural process. Anapanasati is good enough in itself. Dear Arjuna, from how to let go of our loved ones when they are leaving us behind due to sickness or old age? If it's a loved one, don't you love them? Or is it just you love yourself? You don't think of them. They are happy to go. Well, I don't know how I'm going to live without you. Daddy, don't die now. And Daddy said, look, I'm hurting, I'm old. Let me go, I want to go. No. Or like, I don't know, but we did this little exercise in, what was it, Hong Kong, about people dying. And apparently this is in the movies or the TV, I don't know. But when somebody is dying, they say, stay with me, stay with me. Don't close your eyes. Don't go towards the light, whatever it is. Stay with me, stay with me. Why? I'm dying. Pass out. Nothing to do with you. No, dying is such a personal process. And why do you have to worry about your so-called loved ones? Emotional baggage. Come on. If you really love your mother and father, when they're on their deathbed, the greatest act of love is to let them go. My story is Mark over in Thailand. He got two strange, he was a wonderful monk. He was a Rhodes Scholar in Oxford. And he was from Tennessee. He spoke with a really deep southern accent. And we just loved hearing him speak. Just, it's really beautiful, just the way he pronounced it. Hi, y'all. I don't know what that sounded like. But anyway, he had really good one. But he got two strains of typhoid at the same time. My typhoid here was pretty bad. I don't know how he managed that. It was three strains of it. He got two at once. Anyway, he came so close to dying, they managed to save his life just. Because remember that we didn't know what was really going on. He's had a fever, just stay in the monastery, and a doctor just happened to come to visit, took one look at that guy, get him to Bangkok now. There's only one way to get him there, was on the overnight train. So, he got first class seats. They had like a sleeper there. Then the doctor rang up his mate, his friend in Bangkok, and they had an ambulance in the Kuala Lumpur station on the platform. They're waiting for him to pick up. It's a medical emergency. I remember talking to the doctor who was actually in that ambulance on the platform waiting for him. And said, as soon as he saw him, no, he's not going to make it possible. The doctor was actually surprised that he could actually get into the hospital in time. So he was really close to death. He never really recovered.
He's always sick
and bedridden.
And
we decided to send him to the UK, and to the monastery there, Chitwell. Because, you know, we thought you'd get much, it was totally ridiculous, but we thought Western medicine, modern country, you'd get better medical care. Same medical care, only you have to pay more. But there's also alternative stuff as well. So there is money on every type of medical treatment you can ever imagine. Money was not really a matter that so many people wanted to look after this monk. And I remember going to see him when I visited there. He's a good old friend. And he was in the attic. In a big old manor house, Chitwell. That's where they used to put crazy people in English big houses, in the attic. Have you ever read, was it Jane Eyre or one of those? Well, one of those ones anyway. All the mad people up in the attic, locked away. And that's what he reminded me of. Because he could never leave the attic. He didn't have enough strength. Every time he felt a good day, which maybe once every 2 or 3 months, he'd get to the door and collapse and have to fall back into bed. So it was really sad. He was a champion wrestler. And to be a Rhodes Scot, he had to be good at some sport as well. So it was one day the head monk had some insight, went up to his room and said, "I've come up here on behalf of all of the lay people who support this monastery, on behalf of your family back in Tennessee, and all the monks who know and care for you, I've come up here to give you permission to die. You don't have to get well. Stop trying so hard to recover." And on that, this really tough guy, he burst out crying. He wept and wept and wept. And from that time on, he started to recover. He's still alive today. He did this road, he ran away with the nun. Well, you know, at least he had the strength to run away with her. Anyway, he still was a good friend. And so that was done when he recovered, when he started trying to get better. Don't remember that. So, you always love someone enough to give them permission to die. It's not about you, it's about them. So be selfless, Mum. If you really want to die, go ahead. Don't worry about us. How many of you have ever noticed that you're with your granddaddy or your mother and she's sick in the ICU and you're around there, you know, holding her hand, trying to talk to her, trying to be there for the last moment, and nothing's happening, and you think, "We're hungry. Let's just go out and get something to eat quickly, we come back again." And as soon as you're out of the room, mother dies. Why? It's because you've been stopping her. You know, see, death is a private moment. So if you're around there crying and wailing and, "Oh, don't die, mummy," then what she really wants to say, "Get out. You know, it's my body, my life is the end now, I want to die. So I can't die in front of you, so I'm taking your trousers off in front of people. You do that in a quiet, secluded place." So, this is actually, if you really love someone, you let them die. Why? Because the more you hold on to them, the more you're extending the suffering. So that's how you let go of your loved ones when they're leaving us. Because you love them, you want them to be free. "Dear Ajahn, your core message seems to be let go. It is clear how to let go when you hold something in your mind, but how do you let go when something in your mind holds you?" It's the same, there's no you there, which is usually the case. Let go sounds a bit like "be happy," a wish, not a know-how. Exactly where this is what we learn, how to let go. And it's also one of the reasons why when I do the guided meditation, I ask you to be like aware of feelings in the body. You may have an ache somewhere, not as bad as my food poisoning or something, just an ache somewhere or an itch somewhere. Be mindful of it and use trial and error. try this, try that, try something else, until that feeling relaxes, it gets better. What you did, you let go. That is letting go. With mind food poisoning, trying a few things is incredible pain, and you've got time to do less. I recognize that was kindness. So you learn what kindness, what letting go is, all the same, by how it affects your body, how it relaxes. I'm now going to relax my body. Ah, that's nice. I am now letting go of, no, what this looks like on camera. Or what people are going to say about it. Ah. And I can feel everything get loose and relax. That was letting go. So letting go is not, you don't discover what letting go is by thinking about it and pondering it. Letting go is what relaxes things. I did the first day of the retreat, I gave the example of a guitar string. The only way you can make it make a sound is to pull it at both ends, so it's taut. It is under stress, being pulled at both ends. And if I loosen the tension, then when something hits it, it doesn't make such a high pitch, it's a lower pitch. And when I loosen it even more, and when I really loosen it, let go of it totally, it doesn't make any sound at all. That's called letting go. If you are highly strung, they use that metaphor in English, the slightest thing upsets you. But if you are letting go, you are relaxed in body and mind. Anything which hits you doesn't make a sound. You are so soft, nothing reverberates. Someone slams the door, it doesn't echo because you are not taut. You're not tight, you're not under stress. You know what it's like when you're really under stress?
One more word out of you!
That's what happens, you get just so uptight, tight, it's in stress. Letting go is the opposite. So you can imagine a guitar string, imagine losing both ends. That's called letting go. Another way, how do you let go? The baggage, the shopping bags, fast. You can imagine yourself putting it out and then you let go. So much similes you have for letting go. So you visualize it. In a letting go which you can recognize in your ordinary life, and you apply that onto your body, and it relaxes. And that's where you learn what letting go is, and then you apply it to your emotional world. Then you let it go. It becomes a skill which you learn from experience and practice. Does one need to terminate sensual experience, pleasures involving the senses like sex to be able to experience shyness? No. Remember, I had my first deep experience when I was a layperson, and that was about 4 or 5 days after having sex with my girlfriend in Gloucester. I'm quite open about this. I was a layperson at the time, by the way. But that really grew me. So yeah, I was enjoying sensory pleasures, but still managed to push that letting go back. But, you know, but it makes it easier the more you let go. It's possible. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to teach it. Judge of Brahma, deep meditation, my heart beats very fast, and my body moves or stretches when I let go of controlling it. Any sense of calming myself at this stage? Yes, I meant to say this. When your heart is beating fast, it's a kind of excitement. But it's so hard when you get to excitement to focus on your heart and just to relax. It just focus on it makes it worse. So there was a simile of, I did mention it in the first part of the retreat, of the TV screen. When you first watch a TV screen, you see what's beyond the screen, above, below, to the left and right in the shape of the screen, but after a small while, your mind fits perfectly into the screen. Whether you're watching a movie on an iPhone, on a huge screen, on a theatre like they used to have, the experience is exactly the same. Because your mind just fits in, almost perfectly, to the size of the screen. You don't notice how big or small it is. The only time you know how big the screen is when it's not turned on. So anyway, there you are. You're watching the screen and all that's outside the screen vanishes. It's called focusing, zooming in. And that's what you do if you've got trouble with the heartbeat. Don't try and get rid of the heartbeat. It means that you are actually bringing that distraction into the center of the screen and anything else like the breath will vanish. So you center. Just keep on the center. So you're watching the breathing. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. And there is a noise, but the noise is over here somewhere. If you worry about it and wonder who did that, it's like you're bringing the noise into the center of your screen and the breath vanishes. If you have like a thought comes up, yeah, the thought's over here somewhere, it's not important, none of my business, none of your, the breath is my business, you keep that in the center. And after a while, everything else falls off the screen. As you focus on whatever's in the center, whatever you give importance to, that's in the center and that will prevail. So, you can, you have the heartbeat, it's a disturbance, but don't focus on it. Focus on the breath. You can feel the breath going in and going out. The heartbeat, you can feel it over here. Keep focusing in on the breath and the heartbeat will slowly just vanish and disappear. That's how we deal with destruction, with our distractions. Which means that they just vanish because we focus on something like the breath, not like the minutum. That's the best way I've always found when you get sort of the heartbeat gets very excited. And in the deep meditation is exciting. There's amazing stuff happening. And it disturbs the meditation, breaks it. So the lovely light comes up in minutum and your heart starts beating. Watch the heartbeat, not in the center, but on the edge somewhere. And keep the center on the limiter, and after a while the heartbeat will vanish. Your body moves and stretches when you let go of control. You think, yeah, great. Just the body doing its thing. Where you go to sleep at night, you control the body. But the body turns when it needs to turn. It breathes when it needs to breathe. I'm sure it stretches when it needs to stretch. And you don't have any control over it whatsoever. The body does much better when you're not controlling it. And that's what it usually heals us on. But there's a stretching, the body just needs to stretch. I know that I used to get very sleepy when I started meditating, and I was always having my head down, straining my body, and it was down again. And then after a while, I just gave up. If you want to hunch up, body, that's fine by me. But many of you had that experience, you're hunched up, and then your body suddenly straightens. You didn't do it. I never gave that order, you did it by yourself, totally automatic. It's wonderful when that happens. It shows you don't need to be a control freak. Sometimes when you do your walking meditation, I haven't said much about walking meditation, eh? Anyone doing any walking meditation here? Some people aren't. But have you ever done a walking meditation and after a while you don't do the walking? Body does the walking, you're just sitting or standing there, you don't tell the leg what to do, it does it automatically. That's really cool when, you know, it happens and you're just not doing anything, you're just watching. And it just walks. Apparently that's what happened with soldiers when they used to go on marches before the time they had troop carriers. And so they used to send these soldiers all over the country by marching. And it was well documented that many soldiers would go to sleep. They'd been up all day, fighting or something, marching all night, and they were still walking. They're fast asleep. And their legs just carried on walking. Totally automatic. It's great because it just shows you what you think you control, you don't control. Do I jump around? If I'm not a vegetarian, do I encourage killing as a Buddhist? You support killing, but even vegetables. you support killing because many of the festivals have to be sprayed. I remember just living in the northeast of Thailand when it came to the season for planting rice. And I always wondered, where are all the birds doing following the flower? And then you look closely, when they plow the fields to sow the rice, many beetles and worms come up, and then a bird. Now that's pretty much. So all eating is at the expense of others. So our job is to try and limit it as much as we possibly can. But whatever you eat, it always is at the expense of others. Dear Agnani, in meditation practice you teach that we should not be control freaks. In daily life, when I'm a witness or part of any incident, sometimes bad, perverted thoughts arises. I have tried to control, suppress this, usually failing miserably. Should I just allow such thoughts to be formed? Yes. Isn't it bad karma? No. How do I react? With kindness. I understand the correct way is not to react, but sometimes it just comes out. I thought, it's just old karma. That's why once we think that way, it's all karma, those thoughts. Our job is not to make more bad karma by reacting in a negative way to the thoughts which are arising now. So you have what you think is a bad thought, make peace with it, be kind, be gentle, and then it vanishes. My story of the range retreat which I had spent in the north of Thailand, a perfect monastery. No one was there, and I asked the villagers, why aren't there more monks up in the mountains? They said it was too quiet. Many monks couldn't stand the peace. A beautiful cave which I used to spend so much time meditating in. And to this day, the cave was full of bats. And such beautiful experiences there. To this day, whenever I smell bat shit, it's a beautiful smell. It is this association with a wonderful time of my life. The same as whenever I smell tar, because I used to spend so much time in my youth playing soccer. One of the places I played soccer was a local park, and during the Second World War, anything metal was melted down to make bombs and tanks and stuff. So the metal railings were actually taken away, we melted down, and in their place was wooden fences. But because of the weather, you had to paint them with tar, otherwise they would rot. So I spent so much time smelling the freshly painted wooden fences, which were all smelled of tar, and that was the smell of my youth. And so every time I smelled tar, it's a very lovely smell. Those are my two favourite smells, tar and matching. It's just association, that's all it is. So if my girlfriend, instead of using Chanel No. 5 and use batshit, I might have actually stayed with her. I'm joking. But it's true, the smells are just association, that's all it is. So anyway, that is, when I was there, here's my story. After a while, I started getting restless and thoughts. So I tried to control those thoughts, stop it. And they got worse and worse and worse. And because I was by myself, I had no one to ask some advice for. And it started getting into what I call right now unmonkish thoughts. Thoughts of ex-girlfriend, thoughts of sex, thoughts of romance. You know, I'm still young enough. I'm still gossip. Maybe one of those ex-girlfriends is still available. No, stop it, Ajahn Brahm. You're a monk. I like being a monk. But still those thoughts would come in uninvited, and every time I tried to force them out, they'd come back again with more power. It was going crazy. They're really sort of driving me mad, so many thoughts. And there were thoughts which I was embarrassed about. So what happened? No one to talk to. I went to the main hall, big Buddha statue, bowed three times and basically said help. And the inspiration came to do a deal. And the deal was, I would watch my breath for most of the day, but I'll give myself 1 hour every afternoon from 3 to 4 p.m. sexy time. Any thought would be permitted. I would allow it. Would not be embarrassed, not to try and get rid of it. It could come in. So whatever you want to think, from 3 to 4, anything is allowed, the rest of the day you behave. Well, that's fair enough. You know, balance, middle way, do a deal. But it never worked as I expected. Even before 3 o'clock, my thoughts were coming in, stupid, sexy, romantic, weird thoughts. And I was so tired. But I kept the other part of the deal. 3 o'clock, I sat down, I was actually exhausted. I just leant against the wall, put my feet out. Whatever thought you want to think, I'm not going to stop you now. I'm not going to try at all. Whatever thought, just... And for the next hour, I watched every breath without missing one. So easy. And that really blew me away. What on earth is going on? When I try to control my mind, it goes crazy. When I let it be, it behaves. That's why I've learned the cause of all my sexy thoughts, crazy thoughts, mad thoughts, is the controlling. I was feeding them, giving them energy. As soon as I let it be, relax, I didn't need any of those thoughts anymore. It's probably a good lesson. Don't just try and get rid of the thoughts. Find out where they came from. When I saw that, it went. So that's actually how we let go of these things. I have cheated money by another person, which is actually worth around 2 years of my salaries. It's probably worth about 1,000 years of my salary. This is nothing. It's great actually having a vow of poverty because that messes up so many records. Like Australian government, like anything else, they want identification. So they say, okay, Ajahn Brahm, give me your bank account details. Don't have a bank account. Credit card, don't have one. Mortgage agreement, don't have one. Marriage certificate, certainly don't have that. And so for a long time you just don't exist. You're off the record. So I like that, especially when you've got no money. And so sometimes people are actually unfree. It's always a bit of a danger when they go to any country, they're actually allowed. How much money have you got, sir? He said, nothing. I ain't gonna survive! Pretty well. Because people can't understand how you can live without a credit card, without any money. But anyway, it's nice to have nothing. So anyway, you've cheated money by another person. Worth 2 years of salary. Do you mean that if I do not need that amount of money for critical purposes, for example, medical expense for saving my family member, then I should let it go and not chase them back the money? If there's something you can do, do it. If you can't, then just let it go. Don't let them cheat your happiness away. They stole your money, but don't let them steal your peace of mind. What's really important? Chasing backward means to sue the person. That person is rich and mean, and you may find another excuse to sue me back. Indeed, if it's something you can do and it's effective, and you have the emotional strength to do it, because it does, then suing a person, fighting, costs a lot. If you can do it, then do it, not for your own sake, so they don't do the same to other people. Because sometimes that happens. If someone abuses you, so I can let it go, but if I just don't do anything, then they'll go and abuse somebody else afterwards. So sometimes, out of compassion, you can fight. But just know your limits, what you can do. If it's too much for you, and you've got other things to do, it's not going to drive you sort of hopeless, then just let it go. And sometimes people say, oh, that means you cheated them in a previous life, and now it's... evening the score. That's a nice way of looking at it. So you just let it go. They made their bad karma. They're going to be punished somewhere along the line, so you can just let it go. But also learn from that, not to get cheated again. so no money to your family. In business, sometimes we trust our brothers and sisters. And I don't know why this is, but so many people get cheated when they do stuff like that. So business is business, family is family, try and keep it too separated. So you learn from mistakes. Dear Ajahn, if singing and music are not conducive to the practice of mindfulness meditation, when why does chanting sound like singing? Not my chanting. I don't think I'd ever get my chanting on a CD and have it sort of published and become number one in the charts. You know, I learned my chanting. I used to chant in public in a football ground. Singing your music, not conducive to practice, because they just excite the senses. There is some sound which can actually calm you down, especially like sounds of nature. You know, we were doing a fundraiser for our nuns' monastery. Hadn't been built yet, so we're raising money for that. So I went to a fundraiser, and somebody made this offer: I will donate $5,000 to the nuns' monastery if you sing a song. That really put me in the spot, because the monastery needed, that's a lot of money, $5,000. If I sing this song, surely Ajahn Brahm, you can actually let go and renounce and be compassionate and kind enough. But it'd be breaking my rules to sing a song. So how do I get out of that dilemma? So I agreed. I said, okay, I'll sing a song, but I want to see the $5,000 check first. So they wrote out the $5,000 check, and I can choose my own song. Yeah, choose any song. So I sung the $5,000, the very well-known classic by Simon and Garfunkel, The Sound of Silence. And I told, in other words, I was silent for 5 minutes. So that's one version of The Sound of Silence. That's what it's called. And don't try to outwit me again. So you have to think on your feet sometimes, it's about it. My husband had been saying, life is about do nothing. And he is really doing nothing. How can I feel he has responsibility and has to work? You see, that's the advice of Ajahn Brahm. To do nothing. So if you're going to live like Ajahn Brahm, I'm only going to feed you once in the morning. You're going to have no TV, obviously no sex, and you sleep on the floor. So if you're going to do nothing like Ajahn Brahm, you have to go the whole way. That'll stop him. Come, you don't have any money either, husband. And also, if you do nothing, means shutting up. Actually, what a wonderful husband that would be. Doing nothing, not saying anything, no more problems. Sometimes people love a husband like that. When meditating, I think I have achieved present moment awareness and silent present moment awareness. I then move to be aware of my breathing. But what feels more like I am taking a nap? But it's just I'm aware that I'm breathing. But then start questioning myself, I can't seem to silence this thought. After a while, any time you say taking a nap, then my brain says, oh, that's a good idea, I will. But the joy is what's missing there. Because if you're joyful, that means your mind is strong, you really know what you're doing, not falling asleep. So, see if one can develop the more joy in the meditation. So you're breathing in, this feels really nice. Breathe in, whoa, that's good. Oh, and you breathe out, oh, that's nice. Put some joy into your breathing. Be You can do that with food. I know now your food you eat here, pretty good food. Sometimes you can just be shoving it in your mouth, thinking of something else. Or you can actually be tasting it. Really taste it. See how much flavor you can get out of the food here. And taste it. Oh, yeah. Don't swallow it quickly. Until all the last bit of taste is gone, and then swallow it. So enjoy it. Like you enjoy your breathing. And also, don't take for granted that you're on a retreat here, you don't have to do anything. There was this guy on retreat, with me, the 3 month retreat, and he got bored. He saw his meditation, said, I don't know what I'm doing. And the answer was, I needed something, I sent him to the shops. He had to go in the shopping centre. I didn't really need it, it was just a skillful means. He went into the local shopping centre. When he came back, he said, I never want to go to that crazy place again. And then he realised how peaceful he was. He'd just taken it for granted. He hadn't noticed the peace. So sometimes we need to pause and to realise just what wonderful it is being on a retreat here. No boss, no work, no traffic. 2 or 3 days' time, you're going to be back in the traffic again, working hard. But now you don't have to do that. Oh, what joy. So if you want to bring up joy very quickly, just think what it's going to be like in 3 or 4 days' time. And then you open your eyes and, ah, I'm on retreat. Joy. Appreciate it. Okay, that's the one. Oh, I don't know if I can do all the questions. Maybe I'll try to be fast. Can you kindly share about the meaning of Om Mani Padme Ho? That is very famous and presented by Singapore. That's a rock pronunciation. It is Om Mani Pay My Ho. It actually means the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Thank you for enlightening us on the origin and danger of Vipassana meditation. Could you kindly share your knowledge and wisdom about metta meditation? There's never any danger with loving kindness meditation as long as it is, may all beings be happy and well, or else. Be happy. You are supposed to be meditating. You are supposed to have a smile on your face. If you don't have a smile on, especially in the service industry, imagine those poor flight attendants. Hello, sir, what can I get you? Here and there, you're so fed up with her. You're going to get her out of the plane. Do you want another cup of tea? Imagine if all the flight attendants were honest. No, I'm not going to give you another cup of tea to change your attitude, sir. So real loving kindness. Real loving. Oh, okay, I can't resist another joke about the parrot joke. Or a parrot joke. I got this in the Impact magazine of Air Asia. Good magazine there. So anyway, it was a pilot telling a story. Totally made up, of course. But a guy was in the aircraft, in the economy class, and he found himself sitting next to a parrot. He said, parrots can't sort of go in economy class. He said, well, I bought my ticket. I'm allowed to fly too. That's what it said. Now everyone can fly. I'm a parrot. Why not? No discrimination. So the guy was sitting next to a parrot. And unfortunately, he put the seatbelt on like everybody else. The parrot did. The parrot obviously could speak. And so when the flight attendant came round, you know, for the first service, the parrot, before being asked, shouted out, give me a whiskey, you bitch. What is that? Really rude. And the guy said, can I have a cup of coffee, please? It's not too much trouble, really polite. And the flight attendant was just so taken aback by being sort of called a bitch that she came back a minute later with a whiskey. He said, please, you've forgotten my coffee. And by that time, the parrot already downed the whiskey and get me another one, you cow. And that was just really, just never heard like that before. So the girl came back again, and with another whiskey for the power, and again forgot the coffee. And the guy thought, the only way you get service in this aircraft is to act by the power. And so he said, and get me a coffee, you fat pig. And so she went again into the galley, and this time came back with two really big male flight attendants, who picked both of them out of their seats, opened the door, and threw them both out of the aircraft. And as they were falling, tumbling out, the pilot turned to the man and said, you've got a very bad attitude for someone who can't fly. Totally impossible, but it's a good story. So, I don't know how to get into that one. Anyway, I don't know. So, well, mental meditation is not, not telling a person what to do. But, you know, just open the door of your heart. So, because the best meditation is really good and accurate, and then it's another form of letting go. So relax, become peaceful. Maybe I'll do more mental meditation later on. When I meditate, I can't let go of control and forcefulness unless I can't get to the breath and flow naturally. Often tension arises from stomach ache. What should I do? Just give up. You can't meditate, and that's it. So stop crying. You're hopeless. So just sit there and do nothing. And then you become enlightened. You can try the Ananda method of enlightenment. Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, was with the Buddha for 25 years, sitting next to him, just looking after him. Seeing all these people come up and say they were enlightened, psychic powers. He's seen so many, 25 years. And as for him, still nowhere. When the Buddha passed away, he thought, my goodness, if I can't get enlightened when I'm so close to the greatest teacher, what hope is there for me now? So he got very, very depressed. And a few months afterwards, the monks decided to have a big conference, 500 monks, to get all these things we call the sutras together. And as they wanted to get all these sutras together, they decided, well, we get 400, mostly arahat. But what about Ananda? He's not fully enlightened, but he heard so much. So they made an exception for him. He was allowed to come in the meeting as the only one who wasn't fully enlightened. You can imagine how they must have felt. So embarrassed, all your friends. You want to know what it feels like. I always say, imagine that at the end of this retreat, I made the announcement that every one of you in this room is now fully enlightened except for you. How would you feel? The odd one now. Especially if these other people, the first retreat they're enlightened, you've been coming here for years, and they're enlightened, you're not. That really sucks. That's not fair. That's how Ananda felt, the odd one out. So he decided to meditate all night, go for broke, no sleep, meditate and meditate and meditate. And when the dawn came up, he was still unenlightened. Oh, that was just terrible. So what to do? He didn't feel like eating, so he decided, I'm just going to take a nap. So he gave up even trying to be enlightened. He tried all night, gave everything he got. Can't be enlightened when the Buddha is sitting right next to him. Can't be enlightened putting forth all his effort. He was hopeless case. So as he went to take a nap before the meeting, before his head hit the pillow, he became a 500th fully enlightened being. Why? Because he stopped trying. He let go. He'd been chasing that carrot all night, actually for many years beforehand. Chasing the carrot, could never catch it. So he let go, he gave up, he stopped. And the carrot came right to him, as that story I told this morning. Not only that, not only that, he had all these psychic powers as well. So how can you prove you're enlightened to other people? If you get enlightened tonight, how can you prove it to me? You're really enlightened, and to everybody else. So what he did, he deliberately came late for the meeting. And they locked the door, bolted it, and he came in through the keyhole. Beautiful light coming through the keyhole, and then he emerged in front of everybody else. It's called making an entrance. He said, "Ah, yeah, okay, cool. You're not going to invite me. So if you want to impress me that you're fully enlightened tonight, then you don't open the door, so all the doors will be noisy. This is a little gap between the doors. Come in through that gap and just appear in a blaze of light. Then I'll be convinced." So we call that the abandonment of enlightenment. And you might try that tonight. Go to sleep, see what happens before you head into the pillow. If it doesn't work once, then get up in the middle of the night and try again. after breakfast. After lunch. Bit of the afternoon. That's not about letting go. That was a trick. Devachar thought jhana was a Hindu concept. Jhana, no, I read somewhere that once the Lord Buddha had achieved the highest jhana but still could not get his awareness, and so that the ashram to go into the wilderness to get his answers. No, there was a story of studying under a lama, Kalama, Uttakalama, Bhuta. It never ever says in that story anything about jhanas. So the Buddha actually remembered, after trying everything else, under the rose apple tree as a 6 or 7 year old. That was his memory of doing the jhanas, not under any other teacher. And he said that, it's actually said in a couple of sutras by Davis, the Buddha who discovered jhanas. Interesting, he says that. I think actually I've got those quotes tomorrow when I talk about jhanas. In many corporate companies, passion is one of the core values, translated to a passion to drive achievements like sales growth or profit. I sometimes find this to be in conflict with the Buddha's practice of letting go. What is the best way to manage this conflict? Passion is good. I'm a very passionate monk. So it's the right type of passion. Compassion and dispassion. Get the right passion. But yes, in work they pay you to do some work, to work hard. When you're meditating, that's a different ball game. That's the time you totally let go. As I told people, I think the first day, we're getting these very soon, the results of the census in Australia, which was done last August. We haven't got the results yet. And one of those questions they ask is, how many Buddhists, how many Christians, how many Muslims are there in the country? And I'm very agitated and anxious about the results. Because if the number of Buddhists do not increase, I can face the sack. I haven't reached my sales figures that have not increased enough. That doesn't matter. But anyway, Satipatthana Sutta, if praise can be considered unworldly and facilitate peace and stillness, does the opposite hold true for blame? Yeah, usually negativity, blaming somebody. It's no one's fault. It sounded like a good idea at the time. Sometimes you thought you were doing the right thing. Blaming you doesn't help. Wow. This is the most amazing question. This even I can't answer. Whoever wrote this, you know, you're enlightened already. The empty sheet of paper, that's profound. This is really the last question. You spoke about being kind to your thoughts, but I find myself thinking even more when I am kind to my thoughts. So I have to stop myself from thinking in order to stop thinking. Is that being kind? Of course it's not. But you weren't really being kind to your thoughts. You're trying to be kind to the thoughts as a means of stopping them. It's just that. It's like the wolf in sheep's clothing. Yes, I'm going to be kind to you thoughts as long as you stop. May all thoughts be happy and well, as long as it's somewhere else except in my brain. So real kindness is letting go. Thoughts you can stay forever and ever, and you mean it. That's being kind. Letting things be is not a means of trying to get rid of them. It's allowing them to exist. And then they disappear. Very good. So that's the last question. Yay! So, toilet break. And then after toilet break, come back for meditation break. Very good. Off you go. Let go, let go, let go. Sorry? 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever. Because we started early, it's only 8 minutes, so go maybe 9:15 if necessary. Okay, all books aside.